Hi, you're listening to The West Wing Weekly. Isn't that how we start?
I love when you say hi at the beginning.
I'm Joshua Molina.
And I'm Hrishikesh Hirway. Today, we're talking about The Drop-In. It's season 2, episode 12.
The teleplay by one Aaron Sorkin. The story by Mr. Lawrence O'Donnell Jr. The direction by Lou Antonio. I looked him up. Lou was an actor in addition to being a director. He was in Cool Hand Luke and Gunsmoke and a lot of other old classic type things.
A few listeners have written into us recently, and we've talked about this in the past, I think, asking about the difference between story by and teleplay by.
Okay. Teleplay by, the actual script, dialogue, descriptions, everything written. Story, the plotting.
The ideas.
The ideas, sure. Does it ever say written by? I think sometimes I say written by rather than teleplay by, but those are identical. I think in the credits they say teleplay.
Mm-hmm. I think the question is like, what's the difference between story and the writing? And it is really, it's the actual words are written by Aaron, but sometimes he will collect ideas from different people in the writer's room. The people who've contributed most materially get the story by credit.
Mm-hmm. I think also in a lot of shows, the credits can be misleading. This would not be The West Wing, but in a lot of shows, things are written by the whole staff.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of take turns getting the credit and getting more money. They kind of pass it around. And so sometimes it can be misleading when it seems like it was written by one person, but it was really a group effort.
Yeah.
That being said, on The West Wing, I think even when other people are writing things, everything eventually, you know, went through Aaron and Aaron would write a full script. Mm-hmm. That's my sense.
Here's the synopsis of the episode from TV Guide. Lord John Marbury, a friend of the president's and a royal pain in Leo's neck, is appointed Britain's ambassador to the U.S. Toby and Sam wrangle over an address the president is to give an environmental group. Leo tries, with no success, to get the president interested in a missile defense system, and CJ is enlisted to ask a controversial comedian to decline an invitation to perform at a dinner the president is to attend.
By the way, every time we have a Lord John Marbury episode or an episode in which he appears, a lot of people write comments about the naming of Lord John.
This is exactly what I was going to bring up too.
Okay. Because apparently he would never be referred to as Lord. I can't even really follow the explanation of it, although I'm just assuming from the volume of response that these watchers and listeners are correct, that it would be Lord John, but it wouldn't be Lord Marbury. And I can't quite follow it, but those who follow these things are quite convinced.
He would be John Lord Marbury. They wouldn't throw his first name in there. He's not Lord John Marbury. He's Lord Marbury.
Okay. So that's been acknowledged by us. And we can go on with our lives.
I was going to read a little bit from, we've gotten several comments. Here's an excerpt from the longest one from a listener, Edward.
Oh. Bring it.
Edward says, I wanted to get in touch with something that really wound me up. As a pedantic Brit, I expect I'm the only person it did wind up, but he's wrong. There are many people.
May not so.
The British peerage system is very bizarre, but there is a specific way to refer to hereditary peers like John. The name Lord John Marbury would never be used. His highest ranking title is Marquess of Needham. Duke is the highest, then Marquess, Earl, Viscount, and Baron, not his earldom. So he would be referred to as the Marquess of Needham and Dolby, or alternatively, Lord Needham and Dolby. He would rarely be referred to with his actual surname, Marbury. It goes on for another few paragraphs. But in any case, this is an issue of accuracy in this episode of The West Wing. And many other episodes.
So what does this mean for Little Lord Fauntleroy? His name is Little Fauntleroy? Somebody figure that out. I don't even know what I'm talking about. He's not Lord Little Fauntleroy. He's Little Lord Fauntleroy.
Well, speaking of British royalty, there are several heads of state who are named in this episode, non-fictional heads of state.
Oh, wow.
You know, like Queen Elizabeth II.
True, yes.
And King Carl Gustaf of Sweden and King Bhumibol Adulyadej of Thailand. These are all real monarchs.
And in what context are they mentioned?
The little spiel that Tom gives in the moment when the president is signing their credentials, he says,
Tom. Mr. President, it is with pleasure that I present His Excellency Tata Sumatra of Thailand, and by request of the Secretary of State, ask that you accept his credentials from King Bhumibol Adulyadej as Thailand's ambassador to the United States.
Right. And then Bartlett's modus operandi is to then make fun of the person.
Mm-hmm.
This seems to be part of the official pomp and circumstance of the moment, is he then insults you.
Gives you a little trivia about your own country.
Yeah, or pisses on your love of golf. And then he's like, okay, now you can be an ambassador.
Yeah. Welcome to the U.S. This is how we do it.
Right. We welcome you with insult comedy. Mm-hmm.
I think that Tom says the King of Thailand's name, which is not easy to say, but I don't think that he says it correctly.
No, I'm impressed. How long did you work on that? Because you tossed that off very suavely with great elan.
When we were watching the episode, I went back and I was like, I don't know that that's right. It's a hard name, but he says Bhumibol instead of Bhumibol. I think the B is more like a P. I don't know if I'm for sure right on that.
Wow. You know, I think you are.
I love when Leo runs to go get the president at the beginning of the episode in the cold open, and the president comes out after the induction of the Thai ambassador, and before Leo even speaks, the president gives this like very quick glance to Mrs. Landingham. Like he already knows they've already got like a private joke at the expense of Leo. He's like, this guy.
Right. Well, as he waits, Leo and Mrs. Landingham get into it.
Yeah.
In rather barbed fashion.
I know.
In my day, we knew how to protect ourselves.
Well, in your day, you could pretty much turn back the Indians with a Daniel Boone musket, couldn't you?
Sarcasm, the grumpy man's wit.
Sharpen a pencil, would you?
Very funny.
And then after he does his whole spiel, the president gives an even longer and more pointed look at Mrs. Landingham. It's funny. I don't feel like this is a new dynamic for Leo and anybody, you know, anybody being like, you silly old, silly Leo.
Oh, yeah.
I also like that throughout this whole episode, Tackleberry, David Graff.
Yes, Tackleberry.
is just unperturbed. Totally immune to any kind of sarcasm or joking that happens.
Colonel, could you walk the president through?
Yes, sir. Mr. President, approximately 3 minutes ago, a missile was launched with a simulated nuclear warhead from the Kwajalein Atoll in the South Pacific.
And it's going to hit my garage in New Hampshire exactly when?
Well, sir, once the missile cleared cloud cover, it was detected by the early warning satellites, which launched an interceptor or kill vehicle.
Like any stray color commentary, it's like it didn't happen.
That's true. He's a military guy.
Yeah.
And let me just say, may he rest in peace. I just want to correctly point out an actor who's dead.
That's right. That's right.
With apologies to Paxton Whitehead, who's very much alive.
Yes. Yeah, David Graff passed away shortly after this episode filmed.
That's right.
Oh, you know who else passed away recently?
Who's that?
King Bhumibol Adulyadej.
The actual king.
The actual king. He passed away this fall.
Hmm.
Here's the thing. Okay, since I've now said King Bhumibol Adulyadej three or four times...
I do like when you say it.
Do you like it when CJ says...
Sir Christopher Kneeling Roach.
She likes when she says it.
Yeah, exactly. And she says it several times, and she says that she likes to say it.
Yes.
And there is like the parody version of Aaron Sorkin's writing is... I saw you do that, by the way. I saw you just make a face at your cat, I'm assuming.
I did. Well, as I acknowledged you before we started, I remembered for the first time in several episodes to turn off my cat's fountain. They have an electric fountain that I've been leaving on, much to the dismay of our crack sound mixer and editor, Zach McNeese, because there's been gurgling water in the background. So I turned it off, and then my cat just walked in and looked at me like, what the f***? I'm thirsty. Can you wrap it up?
I wish our listeners could see what you actually did, which is, I don't even know how to describe it. You kind of looked down at what I could only see as off screen, what I'm assuming is a cat, and then you kind of gave an affectionate wag of your tongue at the cat.
Yeah, I think I might have been a little bit rubbing her face in the fact that she can't have a drink right now. I mean, she can. It's just still water. Right. Apparently turns her off. Hmm. I did kind of do a little lapping face. I think
That's
I forgot that
was.
You can see me.
It was worth the interruption for sure. I'm thinking about maybe we could just modify the format of our show so it's just, I can just be behind the scenes and it's just you and your cat making faces at each other.
Yeah, that might get old quickly. In fact, I think we might already be there. It's already somebody writing a nasty comment.
No, people love cats on the internet.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Even if they're implied.
So the implied parody of...
Of Aaron's writing.
Of Aaron's writing might be how he has his characters repeat a phrase over and over again. One person will say it, another person will say it. You know, just there's these little motifs. I think it's really striking because the actual language that they're using is very specific. And so then when it's something like Sir Christopher Kneeling Roach, it's a little thing that repeats. The language is not arbitrary. It's very, very specific. And so when it becomes this repeated thing, it feels very significant.
Yes, that is true.
That happens a lot in this episode. There's Sir Christopher Kneeling Roach. There's the scene between Toby and Leo when Leo says,
here's what I think.
Screw the environmental lobby.
Did I say that? Did I say screw the environmental lobby?
You didn't say anything.
That's right. And before I even open my mouth, you decide I'm going to say screw the environmental lobby? There's an extent to which we've got to screw the environmental lobby.
But then there are two instances of this phenomenon, this very like Sorkin phenomenon, that aren't just style in this episode. They're like substantial plot points.
And they are.
One is with CJ and Toby both saying,
environmental lobby, friends are honest with each other.
Here's what you say.
Friends are honest with each other.
The president. Environmental lobby, friends are honest with each other.
They repeat that phrase verbatim, as Sorkin characters want to do. But here, it's an indication to Sam that, like,
right,
something has gone on behind the scenes. And I thought that was interesting, that, like, we've got all these examples of this repeated phrase, but here's one where it actually, like,
it's a significant plot point.
Yeah. And then the other one that I think is even more significant is this line, he didn't laugh at the joke.
He didn't laugh at the joke.
He didn't laugh at the joke. How many more ways are there for me to say that? He didn't laugh at the joke.
But what you said was, he didn't laugh at the joke.
There's another, like, a very Sorkin thing of, we never actually know exactly what the joke is. Later we find out what the joke was about, but we don't hear the actual joke. But it takes several minutes before we even get to that scene. But still, we're introduced to this phrase, he didn't laugh at the joke. And just like friends are honest with each other, it's sort of like this talking point. And then it gets revealed that Corey Sykes made this joke, and then the president didn't laugh at it. And then finally, in the like ultimate reveal, he did laugh at the joke. But you've got people not involved in the conversation with Corey Sykes repeating this same phrase. He didn't laugh at the joke. He didn't laugh at the joke.
Right. Well, that's interesting. I guess one of the minor themes of the episode is language and political language and how things are framed, mm-hmm. and that they've decided to frame that little story as he didn't laugh at the joke. And they've decided to frame the drop-in as friends are honest with each other.
Yeah.
And then there's extra irony to the whole friends are honest with each other, because it's that very phrase that tips right. off Sam to the fact that, if not dishonest, they've certainly been keeping from him the fact that they were already on the same page and that they had discussed the drop-in and not shared it with him.
Yeah. Excellent point. And in both these cases, they are repeating this phrase. I mean, CJ's repeating it without knowing what the backstory is, but Toby's certainly saying it, and like where they've bought into the language of the talking point. Like, Josh has bought into the talking point of he didn't laugh at the joke so much that he's presenting it as like a defense.
Right.
And it's not until we get like halfway through the episode that it turns out that it's a lie.
What do you make of that whole subplot with Corey Sykes?
I loved it. I think that Rocky Carroll kills his scene. Like, he's a guy who I felt like he was able to take on Sorkin's dialogue and just knock it out of the park.
I expected that when I was called in any number of places a Hollywood sleaze, that you might have said a few words, maybe, on my behalf.
But what you said was, he didn't laugh at the joke.
Corey.
He did laugh at the joke.
Yeah.
He laughed at the joke, CJ. I've been doing this 20 years. You don't think I know if I had him? I killed that night.
Yeah, he's a great actor. I saw him at the Yale Rep in The Piano Lesson. The great August Wilson play in 1987. He was terrific in it. And I remember at the time, multiple people saying to me, I've seen the African-American Josh Molina. I'm not sure what it is, but I think I've had people tell me that he and I, or I'm maybe the white Rocky Carroll, but I'm not sure what the similarity is. People think we look like each other.
Wow. I don't know that I would have made that connection.
I'm not sure I see it either.
Yeah. I do like that game, though, of the, you know, cross-ethnicity doppelganger.
Yes.
But no, I didn't see that one. But you do both handle Aaron Sorkin's writing very well.
You're nice to say. Well, I've always been flattered by it just because he's a great stage actor, and I loved him when I saw him. Guy's a great actor. But yeah, I agree with you that he killed the scene. I felt like this was an example, though, of a subplot I would rather have seen dramatized. Hearing the story of this performance and the reaction and the political fallout felt to me like the seed of a more interesting episode in which you saw the performance. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, last episode I was saying how great Karen Cahill, that whole subplot worked, even though you never see her and it's all off camera anecdotes being described. I felt like this one I would like to have seen it dramatized, as much as I like the scene between Rocky Carroll and Alice and Janney.
Right, right. So it's not so much that the scene in the episode is bad, it's just that you would have liked to have seen more actually fleshed out.
Yeah, I think there was greater promise there. Mm-hmm. I would have loved to seen the comedy routine. Right. That's the other thing too, actually. A little bit, this is maybe why Studio 60 didn't work as well as The West Wing, which is that the incredibly serious take on comedy. Mm-hmm. I felt like it was a little bit much, this parsing of this single joke that they're not even telling us about, but this whole thing and how important this performance was. I kind of just felt like it's a little bit, it's a very somber look at comedy.
Yeah, but it doesn't feel wrong to me here, thinking about like Larry Wilmore when he was hosting the Correspondents' Dinner.
When I was a kid, a black man was thought by his mere color not good enough to lead a football team. And now, to live in your time, Mr. President, when a black man can lead the entire free world, words alone do me no justice. So, Mr. President, I'm going to keep it 100. Yo, Barry, you did it, my nigga. Did it.
You know, there was a lot of seriousness put on that, on what was a joke.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess actually maybe that speaks to what I'm trying to say, or what I was trying to say earlier, which is I think without explicitly dramatizing it and just having two people talking about this joke that happened, mm-hmm. we don't know what the joke is. We don't get to have our own take on whether the president found it funny or not. It's sort of like, I don't know, in story version, it didn't knock me out.
Hmm. I was knocked out, I think, just because of the repartee between them. Like Corey Sykes has these lines. It feels like a tennis match a little bit where they're going back and forth. And then, or I was thinking of it like a little boxing match. They're sparring. And then there are a couple moments where he kind of landed like a punch, maybe not a knockout punch because in the end he acquiesces, but still he's got a couple of great lines. I love when he says,
I'm supposed to feel good about that? That he didn't disavow me? That I wasn't disavowed?
We're courting law enforcement, Corey. Don't be naive.
You were also courting the black vote, CJ. I'm not naive.
Oh, sorry, CJ. You tried to get one in there, but he like deflected and
parried.
Yeah.
And thrust, yeah.
And then the one that is one of my favorite lines from The West Wing. Even though this is kind of a minor episode, there are a couple of really significant lines for me. One is that line where he says,
that's not...
It takes a special kind of arrogance not to think that that's disrespectful.
Right. Yeah, that was a good line.
That's so good. And again, he like CJ just has to kind of sit there for a second and like absorb that before they can move on.
I guess I wanted it to be, I really think there was more potential to the situation. You could have hung more of an episode on it. We could have seen it happen and seen it play out. This was supposed to have happened so far in the past that I didn't, in a way, buy that they had never had this conversation before.
Huh.
Until now. It's sort of like, why is it still so fraught? Why did they have to work their way through at this point about whether or not the president laughed? Right? I'm surprised, you know, I don't know why she had to dance around her. Why didn't she sit down and say, look, yeah, the president found it funny, but you know, we're in a situation, if you understand the politics of it. Like, I don't know. I didn't get that it was still this fraught thing, but that it happened so long ago.
Hmm. Well, I mean, I guess it's not necessarily that it was still such a fraught thing, but now it was coming up because of this Will Rogers dinner. That like it had been mostly forgotten, but then this would be a reason to have it spring back up because, you know, it had been swept under the rug. But now if they're at the same dinner and he's hosting, then everybody's going to talk about that story again.
I guess. To me, it didn't earn the stakes that the scene seemed to be playing out at. Again, even though I liked the scene, it was a little, I kind of felt like, well, I don't know. I didn't know if I bought into the high stakes of it.
Oh, I liked it so much. I just think everything he says is so good. And it's so nice to hear this masterful take on these words that coming again from a voice, you know, that we haven't heard before, a character that we haven't seen before. When he says, when she's like, what did you expect us to do? And he has this whole line of like,
we believe he's a world-class humorist and millions of Americans agree. But those who are making noise right now are feigning their concern in an effort to frighten white men.
It's just all so good. It's just so juicy.
I guess it's good and juicy, but it's also out of nowhere. So, I mean, I'm not immediately just on board with like, oh, yeah. I'm like, I don't know. I didn't get, I felt like I could have been brought to really caring about this meeting of these two people. But because of the way it's framed and done, and we haven't seen anything, and it's just been alluded to, but we don't really know. You know, and that's something Iron likes to do a lot, is to be a couple steps ahead of us.
Yeah.
But then that leaves me sometimes feeling like, okay, now I'm just realizing what it is. And, you know, I wasn't brought to this meeting of these two people, you know, fraught with this level of tension or whatever.
Yeah. This is not in any way to justify one position or another, but is this an episode that you have not seen since it originally aired?
Oh, yeah. If not. I haven't seen any of these episodes since they originally aired.
Okay, but you've seen this one when it first aired. This is not your first time seeing it.
Honestly, couldn't tell you. I mean, I assume so. Like, I watched the show originally, but I mean, I didn't remember.
That idea of, like, not feeling lived in or something enough, I wonder if I have a different take on that because I've seen this episode so many times that, like, that the memory of the memory that they're describing is so familiar to me that I'm like, I don't need the flashback.
Well, I feel that's right. I feel like you have something that I didn't have going into it, and that's what I was missing.
Yeah, I think that might
also
be.
Also, I can't imagine ever watching this episode again. I'm fascinated by your, you know, watching and rewatching and rewatching. Like, to me, again, we've shown that I don't even remember what I watched two episodes ago. But if I had better recall and I remembered this episode, I'd go, I could skip that one. I mean, like, why would you rewatch this episode?
Well, I love that. It takes a special kind of arrogance not to think that's a disrespectful line.
Okay, well, make a gif.
My other favorite line, and I think I've talked about this one maybe.
Sweden has a 100% literacy rate, Leo. 100%. How do they do that?
Well, maybe they don't, and they also can't count.
That's classic,
that's
Aaron.
So good. So sophisticated. So I'd watch it just for that.
You know, it's a little bit, just to touch on it one last little time, mm-hmm. It's a little bit of Celestial Navigation for me. It's like I wanted to be...
You want him to go into the flashback.
Yeah. I wish I had seen the performance and right. Maybe I had a question. Well, I thought it was funny, or I didn't think it was funny. It wasn't, maybe that was really pushing too far. That was controversial. Well, but Bartlett did seem like he was laughing. Why do they got to sell this guy? You know, rather than just being told it all, I kind of wanted to live it a little bit.
Mm-hmm. For me, it goes a little bit with the joke, you know, in post hoc ergo propter hoc, the joke about the hats. We don't actually hear the joke there
right.
either. It's like, all right.
But that's a little comic subplot. That's not asking you to really give a shit during this scene between CJ and the comic.
Yeah. And it's not enough for you just to know that it is a joke about cops killing black men. You want to know what the actual joke is.
I guess here's what it is. I had no investment in their situation because I had no idea what it was about. And then finding out what it was about and having it paid off in the same scene was unsatisfying for me. Mm-hmm. I would like to have been invested going into this meeting between CJ and this comic whose performance I had seen. I just think there's a way, given how little happens in this episode, this is really a lesser episode to me.
Sure.
It's not bad. And I liked it and I enjoyed watching it. I think they could have shined a little bit more of a light on this plot and made something more out of it, and I would have cared more.
Mm-hmm. From a more macro perspective, I think that this is another nice moment of showing where the administration has to, the way that Sam puts it, attack their friends for political cover. I mean, they're not attacking him here in public, but it's taking somebody who has been an ally for them and not being able to embrace them in the way that they might have embraced the administration in a way that feels a little bit hypocritical or a little bit false. And they're doing it both with the environmental lobby as well as with Corey Sykes.
Yeah, the pussyfooting around it kind of bugged me, both with Sam and with this comic. Why don't they just be more upfront? This is politics. I don't know why they did an end run around Sam, made for an interesting little subplot. But I mean, he works for them. You know, he works for Toby. Why didn't they just say to him, hey, we're going to do this drop-in. I know you're not going to be happy about it. And maybe you're not going to get your standing ovation in this speech, but this is what's got to be. And here's the political calculus of it. And if you don't agree with that, that's fine too. But you work for me. So this is how it's going to be. Like sometimes it's too precious. Like everyone's worried about everyone's feelings. And hey, well, here's the decision we made.
Yeah. You think? I felt like Toby wasn't worried enough about Sam's feelings. He says to Leo,
I don't want Sam and his 14 objections. It should just be a drop-in.
Like, he doesn't want to have the conversation about it. He's just, like, making an executive decision. He's like, he works for me, and this is the thing that I've decided. It feels a little bit like Toby's just taken offense about the idea that the decision has been made without him. He didn't get to have a conversation about whether or not the president was going to do it, so he's skipping the conversation about what the president should say when he does do the speech.
Yeah, I guess you're right. It's not overly being overly sensitive to Sam's feelings. It's maybe the opposite. But I guess I just wanted him to be a better manager.
Right. No, that I think is for sure.
Be a better boss. Just tell him what the story is. And I don't want to hear back. And because you work for me, I'm not going to hear back. Here's what we're going to do. Just sort of like, just do it the right way.
Especially in the last episode, he already pulled the same kind of move with CJ to her face where she says,
are you ordering me to move it to the Hill?
I don't like doing that.
You're going to have to.
Do it.
Right. Yeah, I guess we're getting a little insight into Toby and his managerial style. Yeah. And, you know, he's sort of gruff and a maverick, but he doesn't like those moments where one might have to assert seniority.
Would you answer the question, tell me about yourself, with the words?
Well, my mother was a descendant of the third of the nine children of Queen Victoria. Victoria was the granddaughter of George the Third, who was the great-grandson of George the First. George the First was the great nephew of Charles the First, who was the son of James the First, and James's mother was Mary, Queen of Scots.
But that's what she wants from him.
I guess so, but it's still
actually
it's such a weird setup and question. Tell me about yourself. Okay, here you go.
Here's a question. Does it bother you at all that he being sort of... it does?
Whatever the question is, the answer is yes.
That is, so he is kind of this... I mean, not kind of. He's a drinker, a little bit of a lush, a lech, pompous sort of, you know, cartoon of British royalty or
aristocracy.
It's kind of a bummer that the women love him so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like I kind of wanted them to be like, oh god, that ass.
I know.
But instead all the men are like that and the women are swooning over him.
Yeah. One moment that I loved is when Margaret says thank you off screen, when he gives the that like awkward compliment slash, you know, sexual harassment.
Your assistant Margaret is looking positively buxom.
Thank you. I'll tell her.
Thank you.
Oh, yes. Well done.
It's a hilarious moment. Yeah.
Like she can hear him and she says, thank you. But yeah, that's, you know, that's sexual harassment. And apparently a little mild sexual harassment just makes a guy colorful.
Apparently.
Ugh, it was pretty gross. All that stuff. When he says,
I'll need some amusement.
Good evening, your lordship.
Excellent.
Ugh, so gross.
Oof. Yeah.
Again, this is an episode where I feel bad for Sam professionally. I feel bad for Donna as a character.
Yes, she's reduced to kind of plying him for potential aristocratic boyfriends or something.
Yeah.
It's just weird. It's really weird.
And that she's going to correspond with Edward, Earl of Ulster, until he goes, you know, like that's how desperate she is that she's going to.
Right.
I know it's supposed to be a joke, but it's just, it's sad because Donna doesn't get to really do much in this episode except for that.
That is true. Yeah, it's one thing where in the earlier scene, it seems as if she's maybe just trying to make Josh jealous by sort of saying what she's saying about Lord John. But then she completely means it because she spends what looks like to be a good deal of time working him.
And I think it's also, when that happens, it like changes my reading of other lines that might otherwise pass by unnoticed.
Such as?
Like at the end, when John Lord Marbury and Leo and
look at you
and
like that, listeners, see what you've done to him.
Exactly. And Josiah President Bartlett when they're having their discussion, their detente, as Josh puts it, about the missile shield, Leo and the ambassador making their comments, and the president says,
well, it's a discussion for serious men.
Oh yeah, and I had the same thing too.
Yeah. Like, whereas at one point I might say, okay, that's he means humans. But in the wake of the Donna plot of like, oh, I'm here to talk about who's going to get married, it felt like Donna was basically trying to set herself up with a season of Royal Bachelor.
Yeah, did feel that way.
Or The Bachelorette. I don't know how those shows work. Which one would it be? It would be The Bachelorette because she'd be The Bachelorette and all these other.
There you go. Yeah. Very good.
Okay. That's all I got for this episode, Josh.
Well, I was having, if not Trump I moments.
Oh, yeah.
I do now watch the show and keep thinking, and I don't have this overall thing. A lot of people tweeted us, you know, oh, if only it were Bartlett and all that stuff. I'm not having these huge things, but the show reminds me of the huge macro important decisions that are just made by the people in an administration. And so while even from the get-go in this episode with President Bartlett sort of drawing out the peanut analogy with Leo and his missile defense system, which made me laugh. I thought it was very funny. Charlie Brown on the football.
I also love Leo not being, quote, conversant in peanuts.
You know what you are? You are the Charlie Brown of missile defense. The Pentagon is Lucy.
I'm not familiar with the reference, sir.
Peanuts, Charlie Brown.
I've heard of them. I'm just not conversant in them.
Leo, were you born at the age of 55?
I know that there's a dog.
Yes. But just, it sort of keeps reminding me, yeah, there's a new set of people who are going to be making these decisions, and the rest of the world has to live with them.
Yeah. Can you imagine President Trump wrestling with the pronunciation of the King of Thailand's name?
No.
I was thinking about this earlier when you were talking about the device of having Corey Sykes and CJ talk about this thing that has happened, you know, previously in the history of the show, but without showing it to us. You know, besides the Teledonna that we have detailed so much, there's a version of it that exists with CJ explaining stuff to the press corps.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, it stands in for the very common and what often feels to me like the cheap trope of the newscaster catching you up on what's going on. Like somebody turns on the news.
Exposition
and
guy.
Yeah. There was a movie where all that was happening via a radio that was on in the car, you know, and the anchor on the radio would be like catching you up on whatever was happening in the like the world at large. And we started calling that character DJ Exposition.
Yeah, that's very good.
And now that's what I, every time that guy, the newscaster, whoever comes, I'm like, it's DJ Exposition.
DJ Exposition. That's
right. And I'd like to introduce that to you and to the West Wing.
Let's use that.
Listenership. Yeah.
We will use it. I like that. I don't know what the hell to call him now. So I'll just say Roger Rees.
Sure.
That is, his tie is Roger Lord Rees. His tie is permanently askew. Right. It's always like, so I almost want to call Lynn Palo and say, like, were you using like Topstick or something? They clearly made it. It's just pinned. Never straight.
Yeah.
And it's actually, it's a funny visual. he always looks just a little bit drunk.
Mm-hmm. There was a reference in this episode to Joey Bishop when Toby says,
also, he's the president of the United States. He's nobody's understudy. Got him going out there like Joey Bishop. I got to say.
Did you catch that reference?
Yes.
I didn't. I had to look it up.
Oh, you mean who Joey Bishop is?
Yeah, and why the president is not Joey Bishop.
I guess he's referring to him as kind of a second string, kind of a B-list, right? Whether, I can't remember the...
It turns out he was the guest host on The Tonight Show, filling in for Carson a record 177 times.
Okay, my first guest is a close friend, a very, very funny man. I've been a fan of Joey's for many, many years. I want to thank Joey Bishop for doing a great job on the show. What was the name?
Wait a minute. I wasn't pinch-hitting for you. I was pinch-hitting for somebody who was pinch-hitting for you.
Ah. Well, I want to thank Joey, who was substituting for the guest host.
Right.
Who was reaped on March 3rd, 1979. How are you, anyway?
I'm fine.
Interesting. I just thought of him as a minor Rat Packer. But yeah, I guess that's specifically the reference. Good.
This is one that I never caught, never even thought to think about until doing this podcast and being like, oh, that's a line that I don't understand. Let me actually put in the effort to look that up.
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't fully get it then. Yeah, I didn't realize it was a Tonight Show reference.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of depressing all the talk about climate change in this episode. I was gonna think I forgot that we were that aware of it that long ago.
Yeah,
16 years later, and we're looking at potentially a president who doesn't acknowledge its existence.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I mean, it's not funny.
When Sam says,
as of today, it shall be the unequivocal position of the United States government, the global warming constitutes a clear and present danger to the health and future well-being of this planet and all its inhabitants.
I didn't write it down, but all I could think was Trump. Ay-ay-ay.
Absolutely. Ay-ay-ay, indeed. Yeah. That is not a statement you could get our president-elect to sign off on.
Yeah.
16 years later.
It was really the word unequivocal in that I was like, I just felt so, I felt as bad for the climate as I did for Donna.
Hear, hear. What say we take a quick break and come back later?
And now back to the show.
Now we're going to talk for a few minutes with Kim Webster, who played Ginger. Hey, Kim.
Hi.
Hello.
Ginger, get the popcorn. Kim Webster's in the house.
I'm always asked to get the popcorn.
I'm glad we finally got you. We've been talking about it for a while.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming and talking to us.
Absolutely.
So let's start at the very beginning. What is Ginger's origin story? How'd you get the part?
I actually was hired as a one-day stand-in on the pilot.
A stand-in?
Yeah, Yeah, so a stand-in, for those who don't know, is somebody that's standing in place of the actor while they're off to do better things, more important things.
While they light a scene, while they like prepare the lighting and the technical aspect of the scene, so the actor can go sit in their trailer and watch TV.
Exactly. So I was standing in, and it was that scene with Josh and Mandy at the pantry in the pilot episode, and I was standing in for one of the college girls that fangirls out.
Excuse me.
We're sorry to interrupt your lunch.
We're juniors at Florida State.
We're with this poli-sci group.
Anyway,
we just want to say that we think you're excellent, and can we have your autograph?
Sure.
And Aaron Sorkin thanked me for doing a good job, and I thought, wow, I'm just standing here, or I'm just sitting here and being quiet. I was confused at how that was a good job, but I was really grateful. And so then they just kept calling me back in to stand in and be an extra behind the scenes, which I was thrilled to do. I had just joined SAG 2 weeks before this. So it was, you know, this was like my first professional job, and I didn't really want to pursue a career as an extra or a stand-in, but this kind of just fell in my lap, and, you know, I think I immediately knew, like, I was meant to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And so then episode 3 came along, and I had been standing in, and I left the soundstage because it was a scene with Toby and Josh, and so I thought my part was over, so I left. And I got rushed back in, and I overheard Aaron saying, and this is the part where Kim will come in and say estimated BDA. And I thought, what?
Estimated BDA.
My first bombing.
Wait, what does that mean?
Estimated bomb damage assessment.
Huh.
And so I got like rushed into hair and makeup. I felt like I was Miss America. And so that was my first line. And then down the road a bit, Aaron had come to set one day. I went back to my extra and stand-in duties. And Aaron came in one day and said, did I give your character a name? And I thought, I have a character? And he was like, I'll be back. And, you know, within a couple of episodes, Ginger had been born. But here's the part in between the meat of the story that I'm leaving out. One day during lunch, there was a cast read through, and Elizabeth Moss, who had just been cast as a president's daughter, couldn't be there. It was the reading of Crackpots and These Women. And Aaron asked if I could come in and read at the cast read through. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to throw up.
Yeah.
So I tried to hide in the back of the room as the read-through started, and Aaron saw me and like motioned for me to come over. And then I had to sit in between him and Tommy Schlamme, and I'm looking across the room at John Wells, Martin Sheen, Rob Lowe, the whole cast, everybody. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to die. Today I'm going to die. Of embarrassment. And I didn't cold read anything. I just had the script and I opened it and just had to go. And it was a scene where Elizabeth Moss's character comes in and they're making the chili. And at this point, you know, I'm 20 something. I'm not much of a cook. I'm a starving actor. And the line was, Dad, you never put enough cumin in the chili. Well, I mean, in my head, no. I read it one way. But by the grace of God, I said it right. And I couldn't believe it, because that's not what I was reading in my head. And so I kept going. I made some choices about what I thought, you know, a 19-year-old college kid with a president as a father would act like. And I just went with it. And I didn't play it like Elizabeth Moss ended up playing it, which she played just great. But I just made a totally different choice because I was on the fly. And afterwards, people who had never even spoken to me had come up to me and they're like, who? What? That was amazing. They're like, who are you? And then from that day on, I think Aaron just kept having me come back and reading different characters. And I don't know, it kind of felt in retrospect like it was an audition process on the DL. And I just ended up, that's pretty much the birth of Ginger.
Huh, that's a wonderful story. Kim Webster, game day player.
Yeah, just thrown into the mix, and it was sink or swim, and I could have ruined it for extras for the rest of, like, you know, time if I messed that up, but guess I did okay.
That's so great. And I tell people, I mean, you have to have the goods so that when an opportunity comes up, you can come through. But in addition to that, I'm always saying to young actors, put yourself in situations where an opportunity, however unlikely, might come up. So, you know, not looking at anything as when you're first starting out as below you or too little or too small to do. So even working as a stand-in, you wound up in a situation that gave you an opening to be great and to shine and to then do, you know, I don't know how many you did, tens of episodes. What did you do, 50 episodes of the show, more?
I think I filmed about 70-something episodes as Ginger. I think only, according to like IMDb, 57 made it to air. But, you know, I had trained as an actor in college, and that was my major. And funny, when I was driving to be that stand-in on that pilot, I was thinking, I'm going to turn around. This is beneath me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's easy to think that.
Yeah, I was like, I'm a professional now. I just joined SAG. I'm a professional and I shouldn't be doing this.
Wow.
You never know.
And there you go.
Yeah.
Did you know, before you actually got to speak on camera and you were just working as a stand-in, could you tell that this was a special endeavor?
Oh, yes. Within 2 hours of being there that first day, I knew. I can't tell you. It makes me emotional still. Because I could tell that this was something very special. So I was, you know, literally within 2 hours, it was crazy.
Huh. I was so curious about what the story was because I saw your first credit on the show on IMDb was not as Ginger, but it was as Kim in A Proportional Response.
Oh, really? Does it say that?
It says Kim, yeah, the character Ginger.
Oh, that's interesting.
Isn't credited until In Excelsis Deo.
Yes. And then what had happened was, I think it was episode 7, The State Dinner. I think Aaron originally thought that he was going to have me be Stockard Channing's assistant, the Flotus's assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And so we filmed a scene, and that scene ended up being on the cutting room floor. And I was like devastated, thinking I totally messed up the whole show. But it ended up working out in my favor because obviously Toby and Sam were there all the time.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about the two actors who played the college students, you know, they only did that one pilot. That's it. That was their only involvement.
Yes.
In the West Wing. You were a stand-in for one of them, and you ended up doing over 50 episodes.
And you being on stage at the SAG Awards, at the Emmys, like, what in the heck?
It was quite a ride, the West Wing.
In Excelsis Deo, that was a really fun one for me. I think that was the first one that I was Ginger.
Yeah.
And I believe Alex Graves directed that. And I believe it was one of those days that we were working probably about 18 hours. And that was the last scene of the night. And Richard Schiff had the giggles so bad. And it was just, such a joy. Like anytime they hit their mark, he just could not stop giggling. And it was so contagious and everyone was so exhausted. But it was just an unbelievably cool moment for me to see Richard break.
Right, of all people.
Yeah.
Of all people. And this is one of the first times I'm like acting and I'm like, holy crap, he just can't stop giggling. I think we did that scene a few dozen times because he just couldn't stop.
Oh, I want that footage. I want that footage.
I love your line in the drop-in too when Sam calls you out on...
Final draft?
Well, it's a 12th draft. Whether it's a final draft is really up to you.
Was that sass?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's funny in the drop-in. I mean, I feel like Ginger is just so eager. You know, she's 20-something. She's just really excited to be working in the White House and just all smiles and the job will get done. And then by the end, you know, it's the 12th draft. The characters in the moment are exhausted because it's like the same damn speech over and over again with the rewrites. And
right, minor changes.
How much did that feel like a reflection of your experience actually shooting the show?
You mean the exhaustion part? Honestly, not at all. Like, I could not be more excited to be there. Whether it was 18 hours, whether it was 2 hours, whether it was, you know, I just was so energized by everything there. So that, you know, even though other people were exhausted and rightly so because they had to work much harder than I did, I could not get enough.
One of my favorite scenes in this, there's a scene at the end, speaking of Ginger's sort of like eventual deflation in the episode, when Toby comes back.
How was the trip?
Fine. I need to see Leo.
Yeah.
There's so much that's done in this little exchange, the like energy you have greeting Toby and then the way he dismisses you and then the just like utter crestfallen quality to your like face and voice as you turn away and you're like, yeah.
That kind of cracked me up too. Toby must have hated having Ginger as an assistant because I felt like Ginger was, you know, like this cheerleader and always so excited, and he would just beat her down. He was probably like, oh, stop with the pep rally stuff. You know, that's what but I guess the dynamic worked.
Definitely worked.
I think we talked a little bit too in part two of In the Shadow of Two Gunmen, of all of a sudden that incredible somber situation that everybody in this normally kind of hustling, bustling workplace had to deal with. What was it like filming that scene or those reactions to the shootings?
Interesting. I was just actually listening to Tommy Schlamme's guest star on the podcast, and I heard what he said, and I was like, wow. That, you know, when I got that script, I was like, whoa. I was like, okay, well, this is amazing and scary as
sure, heavy duty.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember preparing for it and all, you know, the homework that I did for that. And we did some takes where I was in, you know, full on like tears, just, you know, at the thought of somebody that I knew getting shot. And I remember Tommy giving me direction and it was just so great. And he just like pulled me back and reined me back in. And, you know, then I'm basically, you know, there's just like this shake that I'm doing, and it's me trying to hold in all that emotion, and then I don't think that the hug was scripted. I think that Richard just did that in the moment, which was, you know, so beautiful.
Good instinct. Yeah.
Being able to work with him, I mean, it felt like a master's class in acting, and, you know, it was just so incredibly lucky.
Have you been revisiting the show, rewatching?
Well, I started to, like, when you guys first started the podcast, because I really wanted to keep up, and then my work has kind of, like, kept me away from it. But when I watch it, it's so great to revisit it, and then at the same time, it's tough to look back and be like, what I would have done differently.
We hear that from just about every actor.
Really? Okay, yeah. Good.
I mean, that's certainly how I feel when I watch.
Oh, yeah. I'm like, oh, I've evolved so much, like, as an actor. And, like, really? Was that the choice that I went with? And, you know, and then to see how young I was. Holy crap. I didn't realize how old I got.
Yeah, we hear a lot of that, too, from everyone.
Yeah.
Rewatching.
And so what's your work nowadays that's keeping you from watching?
Currently, I've been a producer of a show called Born This Way on A&E, which just won an Emmy.
Congratulations. Awesome.
Thanks. Yeah. So I'm kind of doing behind the scenes now. I still do some acting when it works out, but mostly now my career is producing.
That's awesome.
Thanks.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time with us.
Oh my God. It was a pleasure. It was an absolute pleasure. And I'm so glad that you guys are revisiting the show. It's hard to believe that it's been off the air for so many years, but it's so great to see that the fans are just still just as passionate about it.
That is absolutely true. And there are a lot of Ginger fans out there. I love that in addition to our appreciation on the podcast, which of course we're dedicated to looking at all aspects of the show, the appreciation for the entirety of the West Wing universe from the viewers is incredible. And people enjoy the work of all the actors that created the entire universe. It's really nice, the level of depth of feeling about the show.
Absolutely. And it's surprising that still, even after all these years, people appreciate Ginger. And I, you know, just really blown away by it. Thank you guys so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
All right. Should we wrap it up?
All right. Rishi, Mr. Hirway. Let's wrap it up. The West Wing Weekly is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, made possible by a grant from the Knight Foundation and by MailChimp and by listeners like you.
If you want to talk to us about this episode or about anything really, you can leave a comment for us on our website, thewestwingweekly.com, or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thewestwingweekly.
We've also both just signed up for Twitter. Rishi is at Rishi Hirway. I'm at Josh Molina. The show is at West Wing Weekly. Buy a pin at westwingweekly.com/pin.
It is like the shibboleth of our podcast. We got a tweet the other day that was very exciting. Somebody was in Toronto and somebody saw their lapel pin and they did the signal to them. And he wrote, "I've never felt cooler." And you could also have the chance to never feel cooler as when you are identifying with another West Wing Weekly fan by wearing your lapel pin. So go get one, thewestwingweekly.com/pin.
I'm seeing them more and more and I get a little jolt, a little thrill every time I see one.
IRL?
IRL.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, have you not?
No.
Oh, yeah. I've seen people with them. You got to get out more.
I stay indoors mainly. I avoid people.
That must be what it is.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
Radiotopia.